I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Yesterday, Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, a small power surge on the Canadian border, the trigger for a chain of events that soon left 50 million people in the dark. America's worst blackout shut down New York City, grounded planes, stopped trains, left millions of commuters walking home, homes with no lights and no aircon. But New York City was only the hub. The shutdown stretched west to Detroit, north to Ottawa, south to Maryland. So how did that happen? Many are blaming the grid. The system for transmitting energy in this country is 70 years old, a piecemeal system hooked up as new cities sprung up and grew. Once described as the greatest engineering feat of all time, now it's being damned as a third world network, a disgrace for a superpower. It could only happen in California, said smug East Coasters 7 years ago. Financial mismanagement, energy traders and power sharks. It was about supply and demand in dollars and cents. There's been nothing like this in the U.S. since 1965. Something to do then with Niagara Falls. Blame the falls again, says the U.S. No, it's your fault, says Canada. Get out your high school science book. There are power stations and power lines and juice flowing at the speed of light. So, Connection listeners, we want you to light up our phone lines this hour. Where were you in the blackout of 2003? And what changes would you be willing to make sure that something like this never happens again? Are you ready to turn off your air conditioner, say hello to a new transmission tower in your backyard, or let a new electric plant come to town? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here's what New York Governor George Pataki summed up events.
The grid system didn't work the way it's supposed to. We had this Northeast outage back in the 60s, and it wasn't supposed to happen again. It has happened again. And there have to be some tough questions asked as to why.
So, Steve Whitley, Chief Operating Officer of ISO New England, what did happen at 4 p.m. yesterday? Why did it happen? Hi, Steve Whitley.
Yes, this is Steve Whitley.
Sorry, Steve, a little glitch there, catching up with you. So, another power failure on the line. What happened at 4 p.m. yesterday?
Well, the specific cause of the event isn't known at this time, but we do know that a disturbance happened somewhere in the Midwest that caused a ripple effect on the grid, as you mentioned, all the way from Detroit to into New England and down into, at least into New Jersey. Typically, when something like this happens, it's a multiple event that's affecting like more than one element of the system at a time, affecting multiple transmission lines or generators at the same time, and it causes a cascading event where other generators trip off and you have power surges and swings, and the system islands.
What do you mean by a disturbance, a fire in a power station, a lightning strike, or just a huge amount of demand in one small area at one particular time?
Well, more of the first two, not related to power demand in any particular area, but a disturbance is usually, like you mentioned, a lightning strike, a failure of a transformer, a failure of a generator that trips off a line, which could be caused by a tube leak or a number of things. Many times, if you look at the major outages that have happened across the country, like back in 1996 in California, the disturbance was caused by a line that, in that case, the line got into a tree. That line tripped. Another line's protective schemes misoperated, tripping a second line, then a third line overloaded, and in a matter of seconds, you had a blackout.
But aren't there supposed to be sort of circuit breakers in these cases, or some sort of system that isolates the problem immediately? I mean, if you've got a small fire in a power station, shouldn't there be a lockout immediately so it doesn't bring down the whole grid?
That's exactly right. The system is designed for that to happen and planned and operated for that to happen. But sometimes, it doesn't happen as the way it was planned. And we actually have lots of disturbances and lots of outages every single day. But the equipment works properly and the trouble is interrupted. Obviously, in this case, although we don't know exactly what happened, something didn't operate properly, and maybe some other things operated improperly, and you had multiple outages happening at the same time.
Multiple outages, that's the techno speak from Steve Whitley. Let's hear what it feels like if you're in the middle of it. Cynthia Gardner was in New York City. She lives in Marblehead, but was in New York yesterday. Cindy, tell me about your night.
Suffice it to say, it's an adventure I wish not to repeat anytime soon. And if I'd had any sleep between that and a drive I'm doing right now to New Hampshire, I'd think it was just sort of an odd dream. But I was on my way to the train, the Acela for the 5:40 train, and thought that I'd won the lottery with a cab. And there were just throngs and throngs and throngs of people in the street. And when I got to Penn Station, there was just absolutely people were 40 deep in the streets, and they were extending out into the traffic, and there were lots of volunteers trying to keep people at bay and direct the traffic. But the problem was is that there was no, it was all of the Long Island commuters who really had nowhere to go. They were lining the streets steps of the post office building and surrounding the entire Penn Station, and there was just nowhere to go. All of the stores had closed. There was no food for anyone, and it was rush hour, and you know, water was at a premium, and there was just no information. That was the problem. And the New York City, as Mayor Bloomberg said, their emergency personnel and police officers were just extraordinary. They were so courteous at every hour of the whole experience. The Amtrak people, they were just incredible. No one ever lost their temper. There was a lot of, great pleasantry, throughout the evening, even though it was just extraordinarily hot. And you just had to be kept at bay, standing outside of Penn Station for about 5 hours. And then they allowed people into the Amtrak area at about 9:15, thinking you were going to get on a train.
Cynthia, tell me what the mood was like, though. Very early on, it was established this was not a terrorist attack. There must have been a palpable collective sigh of relief across New York. But we also heard a lot about this sort of spirit of solidarity.
I think there really people were extremely peaceful. Everyone just sort of resigned themselves to, okay, we're just going to be very patient and stand here. I didn't see any display of anything but let's just, help each other get through this. It was really quite amazing because there were just thousands and thousands and thousands of people on the streets. And that was kind of stunning.
Cynthia, thanks very much indeed. Cynthia Gardner, who spent the night getting very little sleep in Penn State Station. Let me introduce my two studio guests now. Bill Hogan is professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and director of the Harvard Electricity Policy Group. And Phil Giudice is managing director of Enernoc, I hope I pronounced that right, a firm that produces reserve energy. For 20 years, Phil was an energy consultant with Mercer Management. Phil, can I start with you? This cascade effect, just explain.
Yeah, the grid is an incredibly intricate and balanced system that has to be balanced continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The generation, the power plants that are putting electricity into the grid has to equal almost exactly and exactly at the same time all of the demand on that grid, all of the customer usage. Every time you switch a light on, turn a factory on, it has to be balanced with the generation system.
So you're planning this, you're planning it, what, you have to burn a certain amount of coal or oil well in advance, knowing that you're going to get a surge at a certain time?
It isn't really even to respond to surges. It is just to operate the system on a continuous basis. You are planning at a certain amount of load, and the day before, the week before, the month before, there's forecasts of how much load is going to be out there, and certain power plants are signaled to be ready to run and do run throughout the night and day by day. To respond to that continuing changes. And as the demand goes up, there are certain power plants that are asked to come online just to respond to those few moments that the demand gets really high for that.
So where does the system break down? Because the way the grid is supposed to work is if you've got a surge of demand in New York City, the power can come in from Ottawa when they're having downtime. I mean, that's why you have a grid. What goes wrong?
Yeah, the fact that the grid is interconnected actually helps to make it more reliable. It makes outages less likely, the fact that the grid is interconnected. And the fact that all of these power plants and all of these load centers are relying on each other to operate as effectively as they might. It actually helps to lower the cost of generating electricity and helps to increase the reliability of it all.
That's the commercial, but it hasn't worked. So is it the transmission lines where it's gone wrong?
We will find out, and there needs to be a very clear and appropriate sort of technical investigation to determine. As Steve Woodley was describing, the problems that were first discovered or first thought of that happened in California in the 1996 event, as well as the 1965 events, turned out to be different as we started looking into it. And so we will have to go through a very detailed technical look to understand exactly what happened. But the likely cause is something related to the transmission systems, and is probably a multiple factors that happen to conspire at the same time in this situation.
Bill Hogan, parallels are being made with California, some of them being knocked down. Is the partial sell-off, the deregulation, is that at the root of the problem?
Well, I doubt that in itself is at the root of the problem. The parallels with California, I think, are a little confusing two issues. One is that California, of course, went through a restructuring, and that had major impacts on the economics, and that's another topic and another show. But they also had, in about 1996, a major blackout that was caused by the trees getting in the lines, and that Stephen talked about. And that there is some, it may be a similar kind of thing that happened here, where multiple events took place and overwhelmed the system, and you had a blackout of a major part of the Western system back in 1996.
But if you're looking at the financial structure of the grid, isn't it the case that a lot of the power plants were sold off to entrepreneurs, but the transmission lines, the towers, they stayed under the old utility system? Is there any incentive for anybody along the way to actually spend the money that's needed to put this system right?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is there could be. We are right at this moment in the middle of the conversation with the regulations about how to provide those incentives. So we've been going through this restructuring. We've made a lot of changes, but it's only partly done. And one of the issues is trying to get the improvements in the transmission grid, and we haven't really set up the rules for that yet. So that is a problem that needs to be addressed.
And who would actually say, yeah, you need this amount of money, and where would it come from? Is it Congress? Is it a federal thing?
Well, it's I think one of the lessons that is completely obvious from this event is that it is a highly interconnected system, that what happens in the Midwest can have a big impact on New York City, and that can propagate through to Canada and so on. So it's important to recognize that. And since it is so highly interconnected, that inevitably makes it a federal problem. And the federal regulators are the ones who are ultimately going to have to fix this. Congress can give them additional authority and so forth, but they're not going to be able to manage the details. And so the place to really address this problem is at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they are addressing it.
And there have been challenges between the states and the federal government as to who has what control, and some of the policy issues have been very difficult to unwind because of that.
We'll come back to that right after the break. Connection listeners, tell us your blackout tales, who you blame, and what you've sacrificed to make sure this never happens again. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. We're talking the blackout this hour. You know which one. Was it a one-off? Is it a one-off? Or the shape of things to come? Here's how President Bush summed up the lessons from that blackout.
We'll have time to look at it and determine whether or not our grid needs to be modernized. I happen to think it does, and I've said so all along. But this is going to be an interesting lesson for our country, and we'll have to respond to it.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, for you to respond to it. My studio guest today, Bill Hogan, Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Phil Giudice, who's Managing Director of Enernoc, a firm producing reserve energy. Gentlemen, Phil, can I start with you? Why is the system so balkanized?
The system has grown up over many, many years, and regulations have changed only slowly to accommodate some of the changes that have happened. Each of the individual utilities used to build their own power plants, their own transmission, and then distribution systems, and they were interconnected slowly. And then new organizations evolved to manage better those interconnections. That's what is now known as the New England ISO, the New York ISO, and so forth. But it's sort of a cobbed-together organization over the old ownership structure of these transmission systems that are still somewhat independently maintained and as best they can are operated on an integrated basis. So we haven't moved, as Bill was speaking of earlier, we haven't moved to a new regulatory framework that really deals with these issues on a system-wide basis as best we can, that incentives are in place. And there's a lot of legacy issues. There's issues of ownership and the folks that have invested in these existing transmission lines, what happens to their investments. There's issues of new investors, how will they get rewarded. There's issues of what's the best programs to actually put in place. The company that I'm involved with, Enernoc, is all focused on distributed generation resources and trying to get, and right now we actually have up and running in Connecticut power plants that are at customer sites. We got a signal from the grid saying we need you to bring up your power plants to take our customers' load off of the system so that we could help get the system back online, and that's what we're focused on.
Yeah, I mean, the way you were describing your business, it sounds very ad hoc. You know, well, we work with small power stations that link into the grid. I mean, is it such an ad hoc basis? It sounds like a sort of...
It's a new programs that have been put up, and the FERC on a national basis and New England ISO is actually one of the leaders in the country of trying to put in place new programs. So in the past, owners have had power plants in, you know, large institutions, hospitals, hotels, factories, and they only would operate those power plants once the grid went down and once there was a blackout kind of situation. The programs that got put in place just recently are to actually enable the grid, the New England ISO, to reach to us and for us to network to all of the power plants that are out there and get them up and running before the grid goes down to take that load off the system. And that is working now. It's at a small level because the programs are only basically brand new, but it's moving forward and it looks like it will be a significant positive factor as we move forward.
He sounds very optimistic there, Bill, but he mentioned the federal regulators. Are they doing their job or are they just sort of saying, yeah, more power, more power? Have they got a really good handle on the nationwide picture?
Well, this is a very controversial issue, and my answer is that the federal regulators, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has a very good handle. They know what to do, and they've been trying very hard to do it. But, and the but is that they've been meeting enormous resistance from different parts of the country, the state, some states, senators from the southeast, the northwest, and the west, who have been resisting trying to get the rules of the road consistent. And I think it's a serious problem. And it's actually being debated as we speak in the Senate and the House on the energy bill. And there are people who would like to prevent the federal regulators from doing their job in this matter. And I hope that one of the benefits that comes from this tragedy of the blackout is a clear signal that this is a federal problem, that we have to get these rules specified and made consistent, and that we go forward with the plans that they have actually announced and put in place and then have been told to stop, which is a big mistake.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Bob's joining us from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, it's fine. How's it going for you is more to the point.
Well, actually, I have a confession to make. There's back in the 60s, I was a schoolboy at Huntington Station, Long Island, and we all had the habit of picking up a rock and throwing it at the photocell on the light pole. I hit the photocell, and the entire East Coast went black.
You're saying that you caused the 1965 blackout.
It's entirely my fault. And to defend myself connected with this, I would like to ask how much harm was really done yesterday. Could it not be that we need to be less reliant on electricity? And, or is it just a bunch of people being afraid that Osama bin Laden melted the ice cream sticks in the ice boxes?
And caused the 1965 blackout. Bob, you know, good thing we're not... Thanks for your call. 2 points there, actually. First of all, Phil Giudice, I mean, has any long-term harm been done to the system?
Well, the issues of people being trapped in subway systems for 3 hours could actually have caused some real harm for some of those folks in that situation. And there are levels of inconvenience. We don't know what the total impact of this has been on people's lives.
I meant actually damage to the system. You know,
the system itself, as we understand at this stage, and it's not completely unknown, is not completely known because we haven't got it all back and running. But the system itself looks like it did protect itself appropriately. And that's why we're able to get the lights back on as quickly as it has been. Not as quick as maybe some would like it, but it is coming back online, and there hasn't been any indication to my knowledge that there's been any major damage to the system.
Bill Hogan, short of spending hundreds of billions of dollars on reshaping the entire system and building all new transmission lines and getting a comprehensive grid across the entire country, does America have to be told, as our caller was saying, that they've got to cut back on energy?
Well, I think the appropriate response is to say that we should use the amount of energy that we find is worth the trade-off of all the other expenditures that you just talked about. And in fact, that's the move that's afoot, that this electricity restructuring is to try to make it clearer what it really costs and let people make choices for themselves as to whether or not it's worth the inconvenience or the value that they place on it. But that's a big change from the way the system has been in the past. It's not to have central planners decide how much to consume or whether to buy from Phil or to buy from a central station. It's to set up a system where the customers can make those choices. And we're not finished with that process. It's a big, complicated system, and I think it's actually quite dangerous at the moment to be in between systems. We've got to finish that job because it's actually quite vulnerable at the moment.
When you talk about in between systems, how long would it take both of you to actually have one unified system?
Well, I'm talking about the rules of the road, as opposed to the physical system. And changing the physical system takes many, many years. Changing the rules of the road can be done relatively quickly once we get the political will in order to do it. And that's the problem at the moment.
We've been at it for 25 years, though, to give you an indication. 1978 was the first of the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act, part of the Energy Act, Jimmy Carter's time. And we've been slowly moving towards the new regulatory system. And I agree that exactly we need to move much quicker and much more deliberatively to the new rules of the road. But it hasn't happened very quickly against many administrations and many policy folks.
Can you explain to me what's going on now? We're being told that New York City is going to continue to have rolling blackouts. If it was one just circuit breaker shutting things down, why are we getting these knock-on effects?
I've heard that. I don't know whether that's true or not. And the issue of this intimate, interconnected and integrated system means that if problems do happen, other parts of the system have to rebalance to accommodate it. I don't think, though, that we're going to have continuing rolling blackouts in New York City. I think that over the next period of time, 6-12 hours, electricity will get restored throughout New York City, and it will be a stable system going forward again.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, blackout victims and connection listeners. Ted's calling us from Madrid in New York. Hi, Ted.
Hello, Judy. How are you?
How are you? Got any aircon and lights yet?
Yes, actually, got our lights back at about 10 o'clock last night. And I have a similar situation to your last caller from Buffalo, except I'm a little bit younger than him. I also grew up in Huntington on Long Island. Now I live upstate, but I was working on my wiring in my garage last night at about 4:08 or whenever the power went out. And immediately everything went dead. And I thought, oh, no.
So you're the guy who caused this blackout. We've also already talked to the guy who caused the 65
yep.
blackout.
And we're from the same town. And then I went into my house, and my wife's like, what did you do? And I said, I don't think I did anything. So I'm also a member of the fire department here, and I drove up and down the road and to see if somebody hit a pole or something. But no, nothing. And I just heard on the radio stations. Every radio station was dead. And then a few stations out of Canada, because we live so close to the border here, were reporting about blackouts in Toronto and Ottawa, and I figured, well, I guess I didn't do that. And And then we just, you know, basically wrote it out here.
So it wasn't your fault. Whose fault do you think it is? Who do you think should do something so it doesn't happen again?
I don't think it's any one person. You know, like your guests there, Bill and Phil. I think it's an organizational thing. You know, it's a whole group. If everything is privatized now, we need to all come up on the same speed. And I have a feeling from what I've heard on the news, and you know, that's trying to be done, but I'm sure it's a big challenge. You know, and there's not any one person we can point the finger at. It's the system that maybe needs to be changed.
Ted, thanks for your call. Bill, maybe it's a simplistic map, but I've got one here. Says there are three major power grids in the U.S. Is that part of the problem? Should there be one?
No, I don't think that's part of the problem. I think it's part of the solution, actually. And as Phil said earlier, the fact that we have these interconnected grids actually enhances reliability because these events are happening every day, and you don't ever notice it because the system adjusts automatically. And they're pretty big already now, with the exception possibly of Texas. But the eastern and the western grids are quite large already, and I don't think there'd be much. There'd be a little advantage to having them integrated, but that's not the first thing that we have to do.
Well, let me bring into the conversation now Peter Baer, because he's a financial reporter with the Washington Post. He wrote an article for today's paper saying this system's crash was predicted. He's just been talking to the Energy Reliability Group. Peter, what'd you hear?
Well, they're going to the Energy Reliability Group is the voluntary organization that is the watchdog, and they're going to conduct an investigation that will go on for some weeks to determine exactly the sequence of events that caused this. They don't know that yet. They've got theories, but no proof.
You quote in your article, of course, former Energy Secretary Bill Richardson, who says we're a superpower with a third world grid. Your premise is this was a disaster waiting to happen. What is the central reason, your central argument for why this was bound to happen?
Well, the experts who know this industry very well say that we have a transmission system that has not kept up with a tremendous growth in the amount of electricity that is being sent over long distances between cities and way, way across state lines. So we have a big increase in transmitting power and no increase in the transmission towers and lines that have to move that power. So the North American Electric Reliability Council was warning several years ago that this imbalance creates the scenario for the kind of cascading problem that we had.
Did you hear any prescriptions today from the reliability group?
No, that's something that they think is going to come out of the investigation that will begin. They expect congressional hearings and a very thorough review of this problem by the federal government. The prescriptions have been debated for years now, and they're an important part of the energy legislation that has so far been stalled in Congress.
Peter Baer, thanks very much for joining us.
Judy, Phil, can I say a word about that?
Yeah.
I think the explanation has a certain surface appeal, but I think it's too simple.
Mm-hmm.
And if Phil is successful in his business, and I wish him well, and he sells enormous amounts of distributed generation, the conclusion will be that we have too much transmission. So it's not it's not the case that we know that that's just the problem and we should be expanding. And the second thing is that if you set the rules up, you can make the rules such that the transmission system is reliable no matter how much you have, in some sense, by using distributed generation and other things like that. So the problem is the inconsistency between the rules and the physical system. And that's the immediate problem. Now, if you want a system that works no matter what the rules are, then you need a really huge transmission system that makes the country a copper plate, and we're not going to do that.
Right, exactly. Phil Giudice, it brings up this central point, isn't it? How do you balance reliability and efficiency?
The balance of reliability and efficiency should be done on the market basis with good, clear regulation over it. And that's where we're unclear right now. There's a mixed message going on in terms of regulatory. The points that Peter makes, the lack of investment in transmission system, yes, compared to the other sectors in the system. The point that we're moving more electricity greater distances, yes. But neither of those points actually explain what happened yesterday. Yesterday, is this cascading event. That event was identified as a significant problem in 1965, and all kinds of new rules and policies and operating procedures and technologies were put in place to help make the system more reliable. And that didn't happen. The isolation of the system didn't happen as it should have. As Bill indicates, if we could have a lot more distributed generation out where customers are actually using the electricity, it would minimize the load on the transmission systems. And it would be a very easy way to start handling some of these problems where we don't have to pave the whole world in copper to move electricity around.
Quick call before the break, 800-423-8255. Marty's joining us from Boston. Hi, Marty.
Hi, how are you? Hello,
Marty. What's your point?
Well, I used to work for utility. When there was a merger, I kind of got squeezed out. I have a lot of friends in the business. I want to just give you a little different aspect. When the utilities were deregulated, it really changed the rules of the game. And once a private person owns a generator, he's going to hold out on his prices, which is, I think, part of the problem was yesterday before he goes online. And the other thing that's going to happen is he's going to protect his generator. If there's an overload, he's going to cut his generator out of there first so he doesn't get it damaged and it doesn't cost him a lot of money. When the government owned electricity years ago, owned by the people, they were told if there's a problem, if a substation burns down, keep that power going until we can fix the problem and keep the whole thing going. I have an awful feeling that when this thing cascaded, everybody said, we're going to set off our generator trips real light, so if there's a big, big load, it goes offline and doesn't up our generator.
So they can do that, can they, Marty? They just shut it down and protect their own little patch.
Absolutely they can. And as soon as you go and you own your own generator and it's millions and millions of dollars, you bet you're going to protect it, and you're not going to get the money that you did when it was government-owned previously. I truly believe that electricity is like water and air. We need it, and it needs to be government-controlled, and if you take it away from these greedy Enron types, you'll have consistent electricity. Granted, you might need to build a system up, and the reason why is, now that they've owned it, they don't want to spend any money on it. They just want to take the money out of the system.
Marty, thanks very much for your call. Important point. Connection listeners, do you believe deregulation put the lights out yesterday? 800-423-8255, 800-423-8255. Talk. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. We're talking about the blackout this hour. And the question, was it caused by greed? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guest today, two experts, Bill Hogan, Phil Giudice. Bill Hogan, was it caused by greed?
Well, that's a great leap at this stage, since we don't know exactly what happened. So I just don't know the answer to that. I think as to the more general point, it is certainly possible to have a well-designed regulatory system that'll work reasonably well and be consistent. You'll still have to worry about this problem of cascading blackouts. And in fact, the 1996 blackout in the West happened before they changed the market design. So that was under the old regulated system. It's also possible to have a reasonably designed market with consistent rules that will also maintain reliability. And the difficulty is when they're inconsistent and the rules don't really match the incentives and the opportunities that people have.
Right. Phil Giudice, you work with small power stations that feed into the grid. If you see a catastrophe coming in your direction, do you shut down your station and say, no, so it doesn't reach us?
Yeah, the focus of our company and our work is really the standby generators. So they are there just to mitigate these kinds of problems. It is very different than, as the caller was describing, which I think was a very real issue in the California economic situation where power plants were taken offline, and investigations have shown problems with that. And investigations will look into these issues here. I agree with Bill, though. It's far too early to say that this was a major factor or any factor at all.
Yeah, but Bill, it does point up that deregulation it wasn't such a great idea, was it? It could, I mean, it has to be undone, if you like, to prevent this happening in the future.
Oh, no, I don't agree with that at all. And I think it's just simply not consistent with the evidence. And changes in the structure of electricity markets have been happening in the United States and all over the world. The kinds of problems that they have in those markets are real, but the notion that they haven't worked, I think, is just simply not correct.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Brian joins us from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. Your lights still on, are they?
Yeah, actually, our local news said that they caught a blurb in our local power plant, caught a little spike from the northeast. They knew something had happened, but it didn't affect our area.
Well, lucky you. Tell me your point.
In the broadest sense of the term, in the broadest sense, I really blame the liberal mindset of the country nowadays. The tighter environmental regulations causing the power plants to have to run tighter. They run it to capacity. There's no extra there. It's just they're being regulated by the liberals.
Okay, Brian, let me put that point to Bill Hogan. Too tight of regulations?
Well, it's too simple a story. And I think regulation is an extremely important part of the story for the new market. You notice I keep avoiding the word deregulated because I think it's just not true. It's not deregulated. What we need is a different set of regulations, and that's the process that we're working on to develop those. And it's a real challenge, but I think the federal regulators know what to do for their part of the task.
But isn't Brian making a good point there that, you know, it's the NIMBY brigade, not in my backyard? You know, if you need lots more towers and lines, but people don't want them there.
Well, that's not the only thing that you need to do in order to get improved transmission systems. So Phil's company can respond to the market in a way that doesn't require that. You can make investments to upgrade existing lines, put in other kinds of things like capacitors to handle some of these voltage problems. So it's a more complex picture than that.
Brian, can I bring you back in? You know, let's ask you, would you be willing, for the sake of reliable, constant flow of electricity guaranteed, to have a great big transmission tower in your backyard?
Actually, I do. There's one.
You got me.
But no, it's not that big of an issue. If people want the service, they need to accept the problems that come with it.
But I do think it's interesting, Brian, that over the last 40 years, we can talk about three or four events at this scale. And so other than those three or four events, we live just ignoring the fact that there is even transmission lines in the world and generating stations. We just assume that when we hit the switch, everything is going to work just fine. And so it's only when we have occasions like this that we start asking these kinds of questions.
Yeah, indeed, Brian. I mean, you know, you haven't had something like this since 65. It's not a bad record, really, is it?
No, it's an excellent record. I think we have one of the greatest systems on the planet.
Brian, thanks very much for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Glenn's joining us from Frankfort, Kentucky. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you? I think this is a very important topic, and I would like to approach it from a national security issue. If it's true, like some have said, that some tree or a group of trees knocked a line down, I was thinking, what about if somebody or some group with minimal intelligence really wanted to do something like this on purpose? It seems like we're very vulnerable. And as much as I'm for a market economy, it seems like this is a national security issue here. And somehow I think we have to approach it as such and maybe have the government have more control over this vital resource, sort of like what the gentleman a few times before said. You know, it's too important to be in the hands of a lot of different diverse interests.
Well, Glenn, I think your question is a bit outside the remit of both my guests. But Phil, you know, have power plants got greater security these days?
Absolutely, especially the large central power stations, particularly the nuclear stations, but as well as large coal stations. The reason that we talk about an event like in 1996 in California, where one tree happened to trip a line, is because it is so unusual that could actually cause this kind of a problem. There are problems in the system that happen every day. They're happening right now in New England. They're happening in all parts of the country that the system accommodates. I actually think for security purposes, we are much better in the hands of a well-regulated private system than we are trying to run it as a centrally planned government-based system. So I'm in favor of intelligent regulation and moving more quickly to a market base to actually put in place the right incentives for people to make the right investments. I think it will be a more secure and a more reliable system as we move forward.
But, Bill, does Homeland Security now have to be a big part of the balance sheet?
Well, I think in case of the electricity system, the answer is no. And if you think about it in a slightly different way, Steve Whitley and his colleagues at the New England System Operator and the similar organizations around the country study these problems intensely. And they are identifying constantly bad things that could happen. What could you do here? What could you do there? This line goes down. That plant goes out. And then they design redundancies into the system so that everything stays up, as Phil has been saying, every day when things like this happen. So what has to happen here for a terrorist who wants to do something is they have to be smarter than Steve Whitley and all of his colleagues, because they have to find something that they haven't thought of, because they're already planning against all the things that they've thought of. And that's why they always turn out to be very strange combinations of events and happening in just particular ways at just the right time in order to make these very large blackouts take place. And that's why they're rare. After the fact, it looks like it was simple. But after the fact, I would have been out of the stock market.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Brian's joining us from Newburyport. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You're on the air.
Yeah. Just first one very quick comment. I was so proud and happy to see how the New Yorkers and the people in other cities behaved. It was just a marvelous thing to see everybody taking things in stride and rolling with the punches. My comment is about, not about the regulation or about the economics, which are, of course, vital, but about the technology. We have globally, over the past 10 years, developed the ability to manage and control and maintain this whole internet system, which is based on multiple nodes of reciprocity and the ability to maintain a system even if several pieces of it go down. If Osama bin Laden or somebody else decided they wanted to blow up several transmission towers on different lines in the Midwest, presumably they could do that. We can't spare the expense of preventing that. But where is the technology that's probably a simple version of internet redundancy management to maintain this power system with probably some distributed generation, but lots of rerouting of power sources? We can do the internet. Why can't we do this now?
Absolutely. Phil Giannizzi, why can't we do the power grid just like the internet?
It is different than the internet, but the analogy is very appropriate. And it really is what distributed generation network together is all about. And the ability for the grid to control on a real-time basis thousands and thousands of power plants that are at customer sites will increase the reliability of the system instead of hundreds or dozens of power plants that are the large central stations. So the analogy is appropriate. We need the regulatory incentives. We need the regulatory rules of the road that are clear that actually allow that to go forward. And we're in the process of putting that in place, and I think this will accelerate that.
How difficult is it? Because, of course, the grid is 70 years old. I mean, would you say if you were going to build the system, you wouldn't start from here?
No, I think that the actual backbone of the grid is just fine. We'll probably find areas that we're going to need to increase investment in, and it's going to hit resistance in terms of the local folks who don't want towers in their backyards, but that is going to have to get dealt with appropriately. And we can put in place our company, actually, in the distributed generation that we're actually operating today, uses the internet to control those facilities. And we have backup systems, and we have pagers and cell phone systems that can go even when the powers go out, so as to get those power plants online. And so we can reach out across New England against the power plants that our customers have and get them up and running, even in a situation where there's a blackout.
Bill Hogan, are people going to have to bite the bullet and accept they're going to have to pay higher electricity prices? Because that was the sort of interim, the way things were in California. People didn't like it, but that was the bottom line.
Well, I think the answer depends very much on where you are in the country. And some places are going to pay higher, and some places will pay lower, and some places will pay higher and lower at different times. And what's relevant here is making sure that it somehow reflects what's really happening so that people can get the right signals and they can give the investments. I think that It is not as simple as that. It's just always going to be lower. It might be, on average, lower than it would have been, but that's a quite different concept. It's much harder for people to deal with.
Brian, can I bring you back into the conversation? You say, why can't you design it like the Internet? Well, to modernize it and make it a snazzy system like the Internet is probably going to cost a lot of money. Brian, would you be willing to pay higher electricity prices to guarantee that it was always there when you needed it?
I'd be willing to pay a little bit higher prices, and I think if everybody's willing to pay, you know, 2 or 3% higher, then that provides a lot of money. However, I don't necessarily think, and I'm clearly not an expert, but the transmission capability, the physical aspect, maybe doesn't need as much modernization as we might think. It's the control of it, and that's getting cheaper and cheaper as processor chips and software get cheaper and cheaper. The thing I'm curious about is a comment Phil made that we need better regulatory incentives and regulatory rules of the road, and one means money and the other means laws. And my question is, which of those is more important, given that we have such sophisticated capital markets that if something makes sense as a business and you can prove it, generally speaking, you can find the money?
Yep, it's the second one. It really is the rules of the road that is the critical stumbling block right now. So that because there is capital available, there are people willing to make the investments and take risks, even if they lose money, with the opportunity that they can make money in this. So it really is getting the regulatory policies clear.
Brian, thanks for bringing those points. Bill, which is it, money or law?
Well, I agree with Phil. It's the rules. And if we get the rules right, the money will be there. And if you get the rules wrong, the money's not going to save you. And so that's the critical thing to focus on. And the challenge, we don't want to what the caller said about the new technologies for switching and controlling the system have been improving, and they are getting better. They're not good enough yet to completely solve problems like this. And deploying them is a major task because it's such a large system. So we need rules of the road. You have to think about the challenge here. I don't know how long it took for this event to happen yesterday, but I've heard numbers ranging from all the way up to 9 seconds for the whole thing to happen across that whole system. You need incredibly good switching mechanisms to handle something like that and redirect a whole lot of physical activity very, very quickly. And what we have found is that the most efficient and the cheapest way to do that is to let nature do it. And that's why we have the grid we have.
And take heart, Connection listeners, that if the track record stays the way it is, our next blackout will be 2041. My thanks to my guest today, William Hogan, Research Director of the Harvard Electricity Policy Group, Phil Giudice, Energy Analyst and Managing Director of Enernoc Incorporated, a Boston-based company that produces reserve energy. We heard earlier from Steve Whitley, Chief Operating Officer of Independent Systems Operators of New England, Peter Baer, financial reporter for the Washington Post, and Cynthia Gardner, who spent last night in Penn Station in New York. Our senior producer today has been Tara Murphy. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
When you're in the dark and you want to see, you need
electricity.
Flip that switch and what do you get? You get a
electricity.
Every room can now be lit with just a
electricity.
Where do you think it all comes from? This powerful
electricity.